One great thing about America, it really is the land of opportunity. Everybody here has the chance to make it to the middle class. You just have to work hard and stick with it. So when we hear this stuff about Black people still having way less wealth than white people, I don't know. It seems like there's got to be a reason. Like, you know, they say maybe it's Black families not staying together or maybe something in the Black culture, like relying maybe too much on the government. Maybe Black people are just not working hard enough.
Yeah, for sure. That's what people say. But people say a lot of stupid shit. Not true. What I know about our culture is that Black people in America have been some of the hardest working and most determined people in the history of the world. You know, our enslaved ancestors persevered through horrific conditions, then years of lynching and other forms of racial violence, often at the hands of the state. And today we still exist within an oppressive system that's rooted in white supremacy. So, yeah, the wealth gap is the natural result of a stacked deck that was designed to create unequal opportunities and outcomes. So to anyone who suggests that the gap is a byproduct of Black people just not working hard enough or making bad choices, you know, I call bullshit on that.
All right, then.
Hi, I'm Tony Tolbert.
And I'm Adam Radinsky.
Welcome to Pay the Tab, where we make the case for reparations, one story at a time.
Each episode, we expose the story of racial injustice. Then we explore creative ways to make it right.
It's been long enough, America. It's time to pay the tab.
So there's lots of different kinds of reparations. There's lots of different issues we look at. But really, a key measure is what they call the racial wealth gap. So what is that, right? Basically, it refers to the huge difference in resources that Black families and white families in America have.
Not just money.
Exactly. Money's a big part of it, but that's just part of it. The racial wealth gap is a key topic for reparations because those dollar amounts that we look at are a measure that we can see today of all those years you were talking about of injustice in our country, all kind of added up. And it really is the elephant in the room in these discussions, the shocking difference today between the wealth of the average Black family and the average white family in America. I mean, it's insane. It's not like double the amount or triple the amount.
Not even five times the amount.
Exactly. The average white family in America has 10 times the financial resources of the average Black family. And like you say, we're not just talking about money. We're not just talking about the income folks have, although that's an issue too.
Sure.
But wealth refers to everything that you own minus all of your debts. And Black people just have way, way less resources. So really, we need to ask, why do white people have so much more wealth than Black people? The short answer is, it's a long and very nasty history, like you were saying. You know, our country has created a segregated and racist system where most Black people have had no chance to ever create or build wealth. And meanwhile, over and over, our government has given out a golden goose to white America. So today we'll go deeper into how this extreme inequality came about and how we've all been brainwashed to believe a bunch of false myths that are used to somehow justify it.
Yeah, so we're excited to be joined today by Marissa Baradarin, a professor at UC Irvine Law School and a leading expert on the racial wealth gap. She's the author of The Color of Money, which is the definitive book on the origins of the gap and why it hasn't gone away. Professor Baradarin has some great ideas for making reparations to Black Americans, in essence, using some of the same approaches that helped white America build its wealth in the first place. Later, we'll dive into one of her key proposals. So she spoke to us about wealth and how it extends way beyond just how much money you have.
Wealth is about assets, right? I mean, obviously, you know that, but it's not. It is also about where you live, where your kids go to school, your social capital, your neighborhood, how policed you are. You know, the racial wealth gap explains, you know, COVID outcomes, environmental outcomes, you know, explains Flint water crisis. It explains over-policing. It explains, you know, where George Floyd was murdered was in a red line zone. It was in a food desert. It's a banking desert. It's an environmental hazard site. I mean, and those are not coincidences.
So how did we get to this extreme inequality? We really need to back up a little because there's a whole lot of history that has added up over time to get us where we are now. Let's go all the way back to the 1860s. most black people in America were just coming out of enslavement, mm-hmm. and the vast majority of black folks had nothing at all. We had the criminal system of sharecropping in the South, where basically black people were forced to work and just make no money at all. It was just this total scam. And you also had the convict leasing system, where all these bogus laws were written that made it a crime to do just about, basically just being black was a crime. They could throw people in jail and then force them to work for free.
Which sounds a whole lot like being enslaved.
It sure does, yeah. And they've said that for a lot of people, the situation was actually worse than it was under slavery with this convict leasing system. It is horrific. So black people at the time had no money, no way to make money, and forget about saving. And at the same time, white Americans were getting massive help from the government, getting land cheap and easy. And you had these homestead acts throughout the 1800s where the U.S. government gave out lands that were, of course, stolen from indigenous peoples throughout the country, and basically throwing the land at white people to help speed up the takeover of the continent.
Like free or practically free, right?
Exactly. And Mirza has actually said that this was about 10% of the total acreage of the United States was given away at that time to millions of white families. And they also say, you know, a huge number of white Americans today can trace their family wealth back to those giveaways of the 1800s.
Yeah, just imagine how the situation would be different today if that, you know, if that land had been spread around more, you know, more equally.
You know, you get to the turn of the 20th century and the government throws even more obstacles into black people's paths, where at the time, you know, most black people were still in the South and facing just daily terror and violence and Jim Crow discrimination. All aspects of life were being controlled. There was this system that just absolutely prevented black people from building wealth.
Right.
And, you know, once in a while, against all odds, you know, some black people did make some money and had successful businesses. But, you know, as soon as they saw big success, guess what happened, right? Their gains were snatched away by government-sanctioned violence.
Well, yeah, we know what happened because we, you know, we're familiar now with the, you know, Bruce's Beach, you know, situation here in Southern California, right? A thriving, you know, beachside resort that was just hijacked, you know, ganked by, you know, the government under some eminent domain bullshit. And, you know, obviously the Tulsa Race Massacre, which was another example of a thriving, you know, black enterprise that was just, you know, burned asunder.
Yeah, a whole black city.
Yeah, so, you know, deeper into the 20th century, the gap continues to grow. We witnessed a housing boom for white people that was largely spurred by, you know, several different government programs, right? There were the New Deal programs. There was the GI Bill, and we discussed in, you know, prior episode how the GI Bill went to very few black folks, especially in the South, only a handful of black folks here and there. And then most, you know, particularly to this episode, the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, which created a fund to insure home loans. These were easy loans, low down payments, low interest rates, very favorable payment terms. And it was a game changer, right? Blue collar workers who were previously shut out of the home buying game could now buy a home and create a pathway to wealth.
Yep.
Big catch. Not surprisingly, black people were excluded from these opportunities. Moving on further into the century, there was an explosion of the suburbs. Now, at this point, the European immigrants, the Italians, Irish, and other immigrants were able to cross over, basically, and you know, allowed into the club, where previously they had been excluded.
Right. They weren't considered white. Yeah.
They were not considered white, right? But magically, they were able to, you know, lighten up and become white or be deemed white. Not so much for black folks, right, who were still excluded from that. Mirza explained how the suburbs built wealth and helped create the American middle class, but only for those who are allowed to live there.
You create Levittown or whatever, Scarsdale or whatever, and you give loans to the white people. And that, you know, and the Italians and the Irish, and that's when they became white, by the way, right? Because they weren't before that.
Yep.
And Jewish people and everyone else who wasn't, just like Polish and German, everybody. So they would have been paying $50 a month for a tenement house. With rats and disease. And now they're paying $35 a month for a mortgage. And they're appreciating in value. And they have a park. They have a school. They have the tax bases. All of those taxes go into the school and that community.
At the same time that this was going on, the federal government created obstacles to black wealth. One very instrumental tool was redlining. You know, we've talked about that before. In essence, again, government created color-coded maps of every metropolitan area in the country, mm-hmm. neighborhoods with or near high concentrations of Black people were coded red and therefore considered too risky to insure home loans. In yeah. fact, there's a line in the FHA underwriting manual at the time that said, quote, incompatible racial groups should not be permitted to live in the same communities.
It's amazing when you look at some of those maps with a bunch of different colors, and basically the very worst color, red, was predominantly Black neighborhoods. You know, the best color, green.
Yep.
There was, you know, lily white, waspy neighborhood or whatever. And then yes. you have all these different variations with, you know, how many immigrants are there? Are there Jewish people? And it was this really just blatant Nazi shit that the government was doing.
The government was doing. It wasn't just, yeah. you know, private citizens, you know, transacting right. business. This was government-backed, government-sanctioned, government-promoted.
Right. In fact, it's really sad, but Adolf Hitler, one of his key inspirations was the way our government handled race in the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, how frightening is that? Right. So the upshot of all that was that Black people couldn't get a loan for homes in neighborhoods on the rise. Right. And then we're caught in this, you know, this really, you know, vicious cycle where, you know, we were restricted to live in certain areas. Those areas, those neighborhoods were deemed less attractive precisely because we lived there, and properties only lost value as a result of that. Right. So as Marissa told us, various government agencies and the Supreme Court treated Black people with contempt and undeserving of benefits afforded white people.
When you look at the neighborhoods, right, that a lot of, you know, Black and brown communities, but Black communities especially live in, it's always been this sort of ghettoized mm-hmm. system. And the ghetto is, I'm using the word purposefully because mm-hmm. it's a purposeful segregation of a group of people in a enclosed space. It's for the purpose of, like, you know, corralling. There's this case called Euclid. And this is in 1934, a Supreme Court case where they were talking about zoning, and they were putting apartment buildings in this one place and keeping single family homes. And the Justice Sutherland says those people, it's like a pig in a barnyard. You know, they were talking in those ways, like, we don't want to, and it's about the children. We don't want to pollute the children. Mm. Okay. And it's whose children? Who gets to count as a child, right? So when you talk about it as a child, like, some schools are good, some schools are bad. Those kids go to those schools and these kids go to these schools. That's the fundamental harm of the wealth gap to me. Because you're saying my kid deserves safety and nurture, and some kids don't.
Don't, right.
Don't. Mm-hmm. And I don't want my kid near those kids. I mean, that is the truth of it. Mm-hmm. That's the truth of it. And it's blatant. It wasn't some under subconscious thing.
So our government had these massive programs for the better part of 200 years, giving out all these different golden geese to white Americans. Mm. All these properties that were made easy, if not free, then cheap. Mm-hmm. Mortgages, this brand new thing.
Right.
And the wealth started building and building and building for white people only. And through all these policies, our government also created full legal segregation in America.
Yep.
You know, North and South, East and West, which we still mostly have today. One thing that really jumped out at me from Marissa's book is one of the side effects of these housing policies was our government basically ensured that anti-Black racism would keep growing mm-hmm. by equating Black people with lower property values, by making that actual law. So white people become genuinely afraid when they see a Black person move in next door. It's like, oh, shoot, I'm going to lose money now. There goes my property value and all this wealth I've built up in my house.
Yeah, well, the tagline was, you know, there goes the neighborhood, right?
That's exactly where that came from. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so we have this genuine fear and hatred that just gets added on to what was already there because of these housing policies. So what do we see, right? We see restrictive covenants, which is where, you know, it's built into the deeds of all these houses in the suburbs and elsewhere that basically only people of the so-called Caucasian race, whatever mm-hmm. that is, can own the house. And you also have mob violence and just all this crazy, crazy behavior that happens when Black people try to move into a different neighborhood.
Well, and Adam, a crazy side note about the restrictive covenants is that they're still on the books today,
mm.
right? Even though they're no longer enforceable, mm-hmm. They are still documented, yeah. You know, which is sickening on the one hand, but on the other hand, I'm actually a little, glad about that. Not glad, but you know, that goes to, you know, a couple of the points that are, you know, we're, you know, big on here, pay the tab, which is truth telling and yeah. reckoning.
Yeah, right? Let's not sweep it under the rug.
No. You can go and do research and look and see still in documents that are on the books, restrictive covenants barring the owners from selling to black folks.
And so meanwhile, black people are caught in this crazy vicious cycle, right? Where, the wealth gap keeps getting worse and there's just no way out. And so Tony asked Mirsa about this when we talked to her.
Black people were caught up in a vicious cycle, right? So we were forced to live in segregated areas. Mm-hmm. The values of homes in those neighborhoods declined precisely because black people were there. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we were largely denied the opportunity to gain access to the most straightforward pathway to wealth creation and entree to the middle class. I mean, is that fairly accurate? I mean, in terms of the cycle that black people were and are caught up in?
Yes, that's exactly right. And it was even worse than that, because you know, you're in this ghetto, you're paying 10 times as much. This is the part of the FHA, stuff that we don't talk about. The second part, which is consumer credit, the credit card is in the suburbs. And in the ghetto, you have installment credit, which is the most onerous. Mm. You're getting repo men, and the early seeds of the civil rights movement was that, right? Muhammad Ali talks about, going and taking furniture out as they were taking it back, right? That was a community protest.
Right.
So it was like everything compounding on that. And it was the jobs left, the white flight, the public transportation left, the police, the over-policing. So it really was this cycle.
Fast forward to 2008, financial crisis, the worst economic crisis in nearly 80 years. It impacted the entire worldwide financial system.
Yeah.
Led to a great recession, cost many people their jobs, their homes, their life savings. So it was rough for the United States as a whole, right?
Yeah.
But it was cataclysmic for black people.
Mm.
As a group, we lost 53% of our overall wealth.
Wow.
And Mirsa described how the black community is always hit the hardest when things go bad.
Everyone would say, like, when Wall Street gets a cold, Harlem gets the flu, right? That is always the case. COVID, look at the PPP loans. Anytime you have a crisis, a recession, the black community is always going to get hit worse. And that's just because of the topography of the racial wealth gap. That is what the wealth gap means, is you do not have a buffer.
One of the myths we were fed about that time was that the causes of this were, bad choices by consumers, right? Especially poor people and black folks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's what led to the, defaulting loans and the economy collapse, when the reality was that it was a bunch of greedy banks pushing bad home loans and making a fortune while Americans lost their shirt.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it was often blamed on, these loans with the special teaser rates that then had all these payments that came due, and people didn't know what they were doing. They couldn't afford it. They didn't know what they were getting into. But, we've actually heard that lots of black people qualified for a regular straight up 30-year fixed mortgage.
Yep.
And they were steered into those bad loans by the banks to make more money.
Super shady. Super shady. Right. Exactly. And banks profited even when people defaulted on the loan. So banks didn't care about the customers one way or the other.
So today we have anti-discrimination laws on the books, but unfortunately it's way too late. Mm. We live in a fully segregated society. The wealth gap is baked into our system, and we need systemic change for black people to ever be able to catch up.
Yeah. So where do we go from here? If we're serious about eliminating the wealth gap and creating real change, first we need to confront the myths that we've been fed and start telling the truth about some shit.
Yeah, that always has to come first, right?
Definitely, right? So Adam, let's dig into the propaganda we've been told about race and wealth.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a few key myths about race and wealth that really all go together. Something like this: America is the land of opportunity where everyone can make money and build wealth, first of all. And, white immigrants did this. They got to the middle class through hard work and determination, pulling themselves up by their bootstraps.
Oh, wait, hang on a second. Whenever I hear that term, it makes me think that I guess black people just didn't own any boots, right? Because whenever I hear about people pulling themselves by the bootstraps, it's always some white folks.
You never hear about black bootstraps ever.
Right. So maybe boots just aren't a thing in the black community. I don't know.
Right. So part of the myth is also that if we have a racial wealth gap, it must be due to some problem with black people, whether it's making bad choices, whether it's laziness, whether it's relying on the government. you hear all this stuff. Yep. This bullshit is just constant in our culture. It's everywhere we look and turn, whether it's, you know, TV shows, movies, the news, all politicians of every party. You know, you never see depicted in our media black people confronting the massive racism of our country. You know, instead you just see stereotypes and lies, and it works its way in. You know, it's like we all breathe the same air. And like Marissa told us, there's so many ways that we're all affected by this stuff.
I have internalized racism, right? And if you're honest with yourself, we all, it's the water we swim in. Some of us are more aware of it. We see it and we stop it. But, you know, as a professor, it took when I was younger, right? When I was starting out, it took all of my energy not to treat my students differently.
Marissa discusses in her book how these myths have endured despite being complete fabrications.
Yeah.
You know, one aspect that's, you know, somewhat under the radar is, you know, government policies are often, you know, quiet, right? A little hidden, not right on the surface or above the surface. One example is all the houses and mortgages being for white people only. Laws didn't explicitly state that in every instance, but the practices, you know, enforced it, right?
Right.
So it creates this disconnect, right? White people wonder, like, well, what's the problem with black folks, right? Everyone has equal access to live out the American dream, you know, just work hard, strive, make good decisions, and, you know, you can do like we've done.
Right.
And on the other hand, black folks are, you know, made to feel like, what the fuck's up with that? Like, am I crazy?
Yeah.
The game feels rigged in so many ways, but yet, you know, we're told that we're playing on a level field. Like, what's really going on, right?
Right,
what's,
right. You know, so it must be me.
Must be me.
We claim to be the land of opportunity and democracy and equality and never have been at all. And that's the huge disconnect that we all face, right? Is that we're told one thing and reality is a different thing.
and we're taught that from kindergarten on, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Pledge allegiance and take it from there.
Land of opportunity and, right, just strive, work hard, you know, stay out of trouble and, you know, all's groovy.
Right. So as we've seen, the reality here is very different from the myths that were told. And the white middle class did not just spring out of nowhere. It didn't just use bootstraps. It came from huge government assistance, whether it was the land grants, whether it was the cheap and easy mortgages, whether it was all these different ways to promote wealth building, especially through home ownership, which, by the way, is a great thing. I'm a big fan of the government, which technically is all of us putting our resources together to do good things for each other. That's what it's supposed to be. You know, we're supposed to help people out and help people build wealth.
Yes.
Just kind of do it for everybody. Don't just do it for one member of your society. That's insane.
Right.
So meanwhile, our government is also, like you say, putting up these huge roadblocks to prevent black people from building wealth. Not just you're not in the club, but we're also going to have these extra rules for you so you can't even get started.
Make sure you don't get in.
Yep. And so Tony asked Marissa about the huge double standard that white and black Americans face.
There's a line in your book that I thought really captured that point where you say black poverty has been viewed as a moral failing, whereas white poverty had been viewed as a systemic problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a quote by Martin Luther King, I think, that starts the book that says, you know, if these numbers were given in the white community, you would call it a depression. It would have been a depression for hundreds of years, like a great depression. The unemployment numbers, the economic numbers, and it has been a depression. Yeah. And there's been no real remedies. And that's the thing I was going after, is the myth that, oh, we've tried these things. We have not tried anything.
It's time to pay the dab.
So what do we do, right? Marissa has some really great ideas for how America can start making amends, you know, and how, you know, we can begin to reverse the effects of massive government systems that prevented black people from building wealth. And the answer really lies in huge government programs to turn that around, right?
Yep, that's right.
You know, things are so entrenched that sometimes it can seem impossible to get access to affordable housing, to build wealth, right? So how do we get it started? You know, Marissa has a really great proposal that she's come up with, and she calls it the Homestead Act for the 21st century. And in a nutshell, the U.S. government would use the same approach for black Americans that it did for white America in the 20th century, which was massive subsidies for home ownership.
So the way it works is like this. The government buys up a whole bunch of abandoned houses in distressed neighborhoods, very poor areas, and then sells them cheap to people who need them the most. And it does it by property grants with super low interest mortgages, and people's monthly payments would be much less than they're paying for rent now. And then people are able to build wealth. And the government also pays for much needed home improvements in these houses. And it would really work just like the New Deal, like you said. Congress creates a homestead trust, which buys up these houses, issues bonds. Mm-hmm. So Mersa has all the financial details of this plan fully worked out and spelled out, which we will have included in our show notes. Mm-hmm. So people get these cheap mortgages, they pay them off in maybe 10 or 20 years, and then the house is theirs free and clear. And as Mersa points out, you know, this kind of action can transform a whole neighborhood, you know, by changing the area from a high poverty area to a low poverty area.
Yep.
So quickly, all the cycles of suffering can be disrupted within one generation, she says.
Like that.
Exactly. So another part of it is where this would happen. And Mersa says we should focus on neighborhoods in small to medium-sized cities that have really broken housing markets, what they call hyper-vacancy, mm-hmm. where there's just a super high percentage of abandoned homes and, you know, it's impossible to get a loan, so all the prices are really cheap. And she says cities like Baltimore, St. Louis, Buffalo, Philadelphia, there's lots of places that have areas that are really ready for this kind of program.
Yeah, now who would be included in this program? You know, we can already hear some folks, you know, wondering, well, you know, it's not fair to just, you know, give this to black people. There's some poor white folks who should also be included. So fine, mm-hmm. right? It won't be based on race, ethnicity. You know, if the goal is to repair harm to folks that were shut out of the housing market because of discriminatory practices, then let's look at that as a criteria, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's offer these homes under this new Homestead Act to folks that lived in areas that were formerly redlined
mm-hmm.
or are currently living in segregated areas.
Yep.
And if it helps, we can also add an income, you know, factor to it, that folks that are making less than the, you know, sure. median salary for that area. So it's not even about race. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, it's always important when we're talking about these things to remember that, of course, there's lots of Americans who are suffering these days, especially. I mean, times are crazy hard.
Truly.
There's a lot of people who can't afford a home, who need a place. And it's not just black people, of course. But, right. you know, this topic that we're looking at here is reparations for black Americans. And it just so happens that, like you say, if you just look at redlined areas, black people were specifically targeted.
Frozen out.
And by the segregation program our country's always had, it's all about race, and it's all about discrimination against black people. So, you know, I think it is important, like you say, to be smart. And, you know, she's a law professor and she's got great ideas for mm-hmm. ways to make things actually happen in the courts and all that. But we should also keep in mind, you know, this stuff was disproportionately based on race and on black people.
Right. Absolutely. You know, we could also, you know, imagine that some folks will wonder, like, how are we going to pay for this? Right? Sounds mm-hmm. hell of expensive, right? And
aren't how we are going to pay crisis? For it?
That's the big, how are we going to? It's like, all right, well, okay, fair question, mm-hmm. but let's get real about it, right? Our government always finds ways to pay for shit that it wants to do. Take the trillions of dollars we spend on wars, right? We find a way to fund that. We fund that, right? And so, you know, we don't want to be, you know, glib about this and act as if money isn't an issue. For sure it is, but let's also understand that, you know, when we want to do something, we find a way to get it done.
Yeah. And like you were saying, our government spends just incomprehensible amounts of money on war. You know, the so-called war on terror, we ran a few numbers on that, you know, all the wars that we created in the Middle East since 2001. Mm. And basically we as taxpayers have spent $7 trillion just on those wars.
Wow.
And with the result of what? A lot of good profits for corporations and executives. The oil companies did great, you know, plus almost 1 million people were killed in the wars. A lot of PTSD, just horrifying cost. But basically, $7 trillion of money as well. And which comes out to, over those 20 some years, that's just about $1 billion a day of our tax dollars. So, you know, what could we spend that money on? Let's say we take just, you know, $1 trillion. And you know, I'm a numbers nerd, so I just ran a couple numbers on that. You know, if these houses Mersa is talking about in this program, which go for about $100,000, including repairs, you know, the houses themselves are cheaper, but let's say $100,000 per house. So take just $1
trillion. Yeah.
That comes out to 10 million houses.
Wow.
And that's if you give them away, right? That's if you're not even counting people having a small mortgage or something. So 10 million houses, that's like houses for all of Black America. right there.
Or at least a decent chunk of Black America.
A pretty good chunk, yeah. And so, you know, and that's just with a tiny fraction of the so-called war on terror. So, yeah. So don't get me started about how are we going to pay for it.
Yeah, and don't get him started on math either. He said he's a math nerd, not a nerd.
We asked Mirza some final questions about reparations and how everyone benefits when our society invests in helping the people who are most in need.
Some white people will certainly fear that they're going to lose out under any reparations plan, right? Mm-hmm. You're an economics expert, and you say that mm-hmm. reparations isn't a zero-sum game, but actually mm-hmm. everybody would benefit mm-hmm. from that. So can you explain mm-hmm. that for mm-hmm. us?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, reparations, I think, is the moral sense of it, but the programs, the financial programs, are like the New Deal. They're just like, it's like dropping money. It's like incentives. The Keynesian spending makes money. We saw that during COVID. Like you spend, and I'm just saying, route it here. We're already spending trillions to boost mm-hmm. the economy. And the economic data shows if you give a bank $1 trillion, they're going to keep a lot of it and not invest it. Mm-hmm. If you mm-hmm. give poor people $1 trillion, that money is going to go right into the economy. It's going to mm-hmm. be like a jolt.
Right.
We know this. We know this. We knew it during the New Deal. If you mm-hmm. give poor people money, that boosts, because if you give someone a house and a job and broadband, think about all of the stuff that starts flowing. You right. get the kids in school, you have that. That's the other investment that we're missing, is the kids and the brilliance, the genius of these kids that we're just not educating right.
Yeah,
we're not giving enough resources to like the future, right? Our new, our future scientists, our future, like, you know, we're that, that's a tragedy for me. I have three kids, so I see it mm-hmm. intimately. It's, yep. it's just such a tragedy. I mean, this is our future. All those kids are our kids. Those are our kids. And until we see that, we're not going to be a healthy country.
Wow. Well, two more quick questions, and we will let you get on your way. We really appreciate your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank
so,
you.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any signs of hope? You've described yourself as an eternal optimist, and obviously throughout mm-hmm. our history, you know, any attempt to overcome racial injustice mm-hmm. has always met with violent resistance. Like you say, any mm-hmm. Black success has been met with violent resistance. Do you see mm-hmm. signs of hope today that things mm-hmm. might be different? It might be trending in a different direction for our society?
Yeah. I think things are changing. I think there is a waking up that is happening. And I think it's not institutions, it's people. Mm-hmm. And yeah. this is where I think my hope is. It is in people that are sick of doing things that way, and people whose hearts are opening to each other, and really just, and this is, I'm not saying this in like a milquetoast way. I'm saying mm-hmm. this in, like, you know, like the way Baldwin talks about love. Or, you know, Gandhi or Mandela or, you know, Martin Luther King talk about love. And what they mean by love isn't like romance and diamond mm-hmm. rings. It is like love of each other. This is the all those kids are my kids. That kind of love, there's no other option. And that kind of love is revolutionary. And it does happen in people. And I think that I've started to see a lot more of. Not mm-hmm. enough yet, but that kind of love, it's just like a tipping point. It's really... You don't need everybody. You need just a little bit, and then you start changing. You start breathing mm-hmm. together. And I think we've been at a point where we actually as a world have to start breathing together or else mm-hmm. we're all going down.
Yes.
And so it's either we start to understand that we are like an earth
all connected.
Together, all connected, or we're just going to blow ourselves up. And that's just a stupid thing to do because we are such a great species. Mm. Like if we're going to Anthropocene, like let's do this right, right?
Yeah.
Let's let the earth heal and let us all heal each other. But first, like repair.
That's fantastic. Well, Professor, you really have a gift for tying things together very poetically. We really appreciate that. Very last question.
Thank you.
Quick tips for our mm-hmm. listeners. If folks are hearing this and want to get involved in mm-hmm. Fighting housing segregation, fighting some of the mm-hmm. continuing yeah. problems that we've had for so many decades in this country, what are some ways that our yeah. listeners can get involved right off the bat?
I say use your talents, use your passion, use your skills. Don't, you know, not, it's not everyone's fight. It's not the same fight, but as long as you stay true and like have the integrity that I'm in this fight, use your own skills. Like I'm just a writer and a reader. So I'm going to read and write my way, but I'm not going to be the builder. I'm not going to like build homes. Like you know, but if you build homes, go build homes, right? If you are an artist, a poet who can inspire people, do that.
Mm.
If you can beautify spaces, you know, go do that. If you can heal hearts, go be with the children. I mean, there really are so many places for people to act. Yeah.
Incredible.
It's not one thing. There's so many things.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you so much. We can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much.
We know how busy you are with your family and your work and all that. So taking so much time to be with us and be in conversation, really, really a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Marissa. Take good care.
Very nice to meet you guys. Thank you.
All right. Bye. Be well. So that was a lot, man. You know, Marissa is deep. That was some deep shit she dropped.
Yeah, she's got a lot to say.
A lot to say in different aspects. I mean, there's the technical sort of, you know, economic side of it, right? The numbers, you know, based on her background. But there was also some deep, like, spirituality or...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that was just, you know, I thought was really, 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 you know, powerful, the way that she kind of brought those two aspects together.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that you know, spirituality and just ethics, doing the right thing, is so often missing from conversations about paying and economics and stuff. But it's great to know that she's not only a law professor, but an expert in banking and economics. So she knows the shit she's talking about.
She definitely does, right?
And when she says that, you know, something can be done, it can be done.
It's really incredible or amazing how long-lasting these racial myths can be, right? The power of those.
Yes.
And how clueless, you know, many folks, you know, white and black, frankly, about the apartheid housing system that, you know, built America. So reparations in this context is really just saying, look, let's give some other folks a chance to build wealth. Give black people a turn with the golden goose and live out the American dream. It's that time.
Yeah, and a great example of that we got from Marissa, which is the Modern Day Homestead Act, right? Mm-hmm. Which can help us reverse the legacy of housing segregation and poverty that was intentionally created by the government over centuries. Again, we will have a detailed description of her plan, the Homestead Act for the 21st century, in the show notes. And this is just one idea, you know. Marissa's got other ideas. Lots of people have some great ideas on how we can address the housing inequality. There are definitely big things our government can do. We just have to get them motivated and get that started.
Yeah, we need to have a collective will to repair the damage that's been done. So we'll give Professor Baradarin the last word here. At the end of her book, she says, we're at a crossroad and we're at a pivotal point in our country's history. And we have a choice. You know, we can either keep embracing our history of racism and spiraling downward, or we can, you know, learn how to move forward together. So to quote, the sooner Americans recognize that the fate of Black America is tied to the fate of white America, the faster it can achieve true democracy and shed the weight of historic injustice. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us on Pay the Tab. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please subscribe to our podcast. And if you like what we're putting down, share it with your family and friends.
And please give us a review on Apple Podcasts. This is the best way you can help us to get the word out with this show. So please check that out and give us some love.
Thanks for listening. Keep coming back to Pay the Tab.
Time to pay the tab.